Prosecutors want a Kalispell woman to get a life sentence for pushing her husband to his death in Glacier Park. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the 150th birthday of Montana's most heralded artist. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a University of Montana student honored for his work helping veterans readjust to civilian life. Federal prosecutors are recommending a life sentence for a woman who pleaded guilty to pushing her new husband off a Glacier National Park cliff last year. Jordan Graham's attorney says that is too harsh and is recommending 10 years in prison. A sentencing hearing before U.S. District Judge Donald Malloy is set for March 27th. Graham pleaded guilty in December to second-degree murder in the death of her husband of 8 days, 25-year-old Cody Johnson. Johnson's body was found at the bottom of a cliff 3 days after he was reported missing in July by a friend and coworker. The 22-year-old Graham says the Kalispell couple had gone to the park to talk about her unhappiness. She says they argued and she pushed him when he tried to grab her.
Other news from around the state. Law enforcement officers in Butte say a 72-year-old man cut the throat of another man during an argument over money at a retirement and assisted living facility. Butte Silver Bow County Coroner Lila Bresch says the 72-year-old victim died sometime early this morning. Officials are trying to locate his family and have not released his name. Sheriff Ed Lester says John Grubb Sr. was arrested on suspicion of deliberate homicide. He was jailed with his bond set at $250,000. LaBrèche says an autopsy is planned tomorrow.
Helena's 11 elementary schools were briefly evacuated, this after a bomb threat was called into city police. The call turned out to be a hoax, and students were allowed to re-enter their schools after law enforcement checked each building. Police did not believe the threat to be credible after the caller mispronounced Helena and provided no details about the threat, other than there was a bomb in, quote, the elementary school. It's the second bomb threat in 2 days after another false alarm was called in at Helena's Capitol High School yesterday. Helena Public Schools Superintendent Kent Kultgen says these types of threats are very frustrating.
It really empowers this person who wants a reaction because they can make a quick 10-second phone call and see us just apply resources because safety is number one. And that's what makes it very, very, very frustrating. But in our society and time that we live in, you got to take every single one seriously.
Some schools remained evacuated for up to a couple hours this morning, getting students back into school shortly before school was dismissed for an already planned shorter day.
Several Tea Party groups in Montana are denying any affiliation with U.S. House candidate Drew Turiano, who has said he was turned away from a Yellowstone County Republican dinner because he was a member of the Tea Party. The Montana Tea Party Coalition says it surveyed its 17 member organizations and said that none had seen Turiano at any of their events or meetings. Turiano tells Lee Newspapers of Montana that he calls himself the Tea Party member Republican because he believes in their philosophy. The Yellowstone County Republicans wouldn't let Turiano speak at a recent banquet because of his racist views. Turiano said the party chairwoman may have been offended by his support of a plan to deport all immigrants living in a country illegally and their American-born children.
8 candidates have been removed from June's primary election ballot for not filing their required business disclosures. That eliminates Republican candidates in 2 House races. It also eliminates 2 contested Republican primaries races and 3 contested Democratic primaries. Commissioner of Political Practices Jonathan Modell says the law requires candidates who missed yesterday's disclosure deadline to be taken off the ballot. 4 of the candidates removed had filed as Republicans for House seats: Sebastian Guillemotonia, Billy Love, David August, and James Davis. 4 filed as Democrats: Senate candidate Harry Pennington and House candidates Laura Springer, Roxanne Brothers, and Steve Gray. Modell listed a 9th candidate, James Barutha, as being removed. The Secretary of State's office listed Barutha as having withdrawn from his Senate race.
Complaints filed 2 years ago by disabled students at the University of Montana have led to UM reaching an agreement with the Federal Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, assuring that UM provide better access to campus technology. Amy Capolupo is Director of UM Disability Services for Students. She says UM has been working for some time now to make campus technology accessible to disabled students. Everything from access for blind students to chat rooms on the Moodle online learning system to a new office that provides captions for campus videos.
let's say KUFM wanted to put up a video and, you know, it's going to be forward-facing on your website, and you want it captioned. Because you're affiliated with the university, you can send it to this new office that has been created as a result of this complaint, and they'll caption it for you. And then you can put it up there. You're good to go. There's no additional charge to your campus department.
Capolupo says UM has shifted resources to pay for the changes and will be training faculty and staff on how to use the new available technologies. We'll also have more on the agreement and what UM is doing to improve access for disabled students tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
Several factors are combining to make it more difficult for Montana farmers to get their 2013 wheat crop to Pacific ports. The Billings Gazette reports BNSF Railway is seeing increased traffic due to oil and coal trains and the movement of record grain crops. The construction of more sidings to allow trains to pass each other also caused delays last fall, as did extremely cold weather this winter. Big Sandy farmer Lakeel Edwards says farmers are starting to get nervous that they won't get last year's crop to market before they start harvesting this year, which could potentially lead to lower prices. CHS Vice President of Rail Transportation Dan Mack says the rail construction should help in the long term, but in the short term there will be delays.
North Dakota Senator John Hoeven and Canada's ambassador to the United States are continuing their push for quick approval of the Keystone XL oil pipeline. Hoeven and Canadian Ambassador Gary Dewar met with North Dakota trade representatives Wednesday in Bismarck. They say TransCanada's proposed pipeline will help provide energy security and economic growth for both nations. The project would move 830,000 barrels of oil a day from Canada to Texas's Gulf Coast refineries. It also would move 100,000 barrels of domestic oil daily from North Dakota's Bakken region. The project has lingered for more than 5 years and become a symbol of the political debate over climate change. Backers say it would create jobs and boost North American energy independence.
A woman charged with embezzling more than $50,000 from the health clinic on the Rocky Boys Indian Reservation will be representing herself at trial after rejecting four public defenders. The Havre Daily News reports Fawn Tadios recently requested a fifth public defender, and the U.S. Attorney's Office reluctantly agreed. U.S. District Judge Brian Morris said he would only appoint another attorney if Tadios would agree not to file any professional complaint against him or try to have him disqualified. Morris said Tadios refused to accept those terms and said she wanted to represent herself at her April 11th trial. Tadios was indicted on four theft counts. Prosecutors say she used the money to visit her husband, who was in federal prison in North Dakota for embezzling money from the tribe.
A large collection of paintings, photos, and sketches that includes images of survivors of the Battle of the Little Bighorn is for sale. The Wrangler Gallery in Great Falls is seeking a buyer for the 122-piece David Humphreys Miller collection. Gallery owner Brad Hamlet tells the Great Falls Tribune the collection recently was appraised at about $3.8 million. Hamlet says the collection belongs in a museum, but officials with the Montana Museum of Art and Culture at the University of Montana and with the Montana Historical Society say they don't have the money to acquire it. The collection includes more than 50 sketches of survivors from the Battle of the Little Bighorn and photos from various Western movies that Miller worked on. Great Falls is celebrating its annual Western Art Week.
Montana's cowboy artist turns 150 years old. Charlie Russell, one of the state's most beloved historical figures, was born on this day, March 19th, in 1864. Russell's classic paintings of Big Sky Country helped shape the world's understanding of the Old West. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us it's a legacy which may be getting more important with time.
The Montana Historical Society in Helena holds one of the largest collections of Charlie Russell's art.
This has all been repainted, the ceiling's done differently.
Public Information Officer Tom Cook walks around the McKay Gallery in the Society's museum, which is dedicated to Russell. The gallery has been renovated in celebration of his 150th birthday. New LED lighting brings out the vibrant colors of some of Russell's masterpieces, the colors of cowboys and Indians, living his romantic vision of a West quickly vanishing during his lifetime. And most prominently, colors of the landscape, where Cook says Russell started his paintings.
That was always the first thing, and it's what he paints the most beautifully is the land and the sky.
Cook stops in front of his personal favorite, a night scene entitled Laugh Kills Lonesome, a dark, starry sky, a dark foreground.
And there's a chuck wagon, some cowboys sitting around a fire having some coffee.
Just stepping into the firelight is Charlie.
On the right there, that's Charlie Russell. That's his horse, actual horse.
It's a rare, serious depiction of himself. Most of the time, his self-portraits were self-deprecating and humorous. He was a modest man, and Historical Society Outreach and Interpretation Program Manager Kirby Lambert says he probably wouldn't have been too keen on such an overt celebration of his birthday.
He probably wouldn't have liked it very much. You know, he was not, I don't think, terribly comfortable in group situations or formal situations.
He was a man who lived the life he so wistfully depicted. Born in St. Louis, he moved to Montana as a young man to work as a cowboy. Tom Cook with the Historical Society says Charlie first rose to national prominence after a Helena area rancher asked the young man for a report on how his cattle were faring during the extremely harsh winter of 1886.
So he just sketched this emaciated steer and sent it back on the stage, and that's all he sent back, and he put risk road on the bottom of it, last of 5,000.
The sketch was printed in newspapers around the country. The original one sits on display in the McKay Gallery. Helena residents Glenda and Richard Habel are looking at it. Glenda says they're big Charlie Russell fans.
We have several prints actually hanging in our home here in Helena, as well as our cabin in Alberta.
Richard says he remembers as a kid growing up in Great Falls how a local bar in town, the Mint, casually displayed many of Russell's works.
Years and years ago, they were never really appreciated until years later.
Many of those later purchased by a collector in Fort Worth, Texas. Russell is very much appreciated today. The Historical Society's Kirby Lambert says a lot of how America thinks about the Old West comes from Russell, whether we realize it or not. Literature, movies.
You know, the things we think about what cowboy life was like actually originated in his artwork.
Charlie knew his death was coming. And to
him, Tom Cook continues to look at Laugh Kills Lonesome, that nighttime scene, his favorite Russell painting. It was finished a year before the artist died. Cook says at first he thought it was a sad scene, lamenting a way of life lost forever. He now thinks Russell was depicting himself being able to go back to that place, back to the firelight, back to the Old West.
Heaven to him was going back into the light with the guys he rode with and living the old times again and never forgetting what Montana's all about.
Charlie Russell died in 1926. He was 62 years old. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Helena.
University of Montana student Tristan Persico was honored this week at the White House for his conservation work in helping fellow veterans readjust to civilian life. Persico and 13 others from across the country were presented with the Champions of Change Award. That's a program created by the Obama administration to feature people doing things to empower members of their communities. Persico is studying parks, tourism, and recreation management, where he leads the Veterans Outreach Program. That's a Montana Wilderness Association program to help veterans readjust to civilian life through outdoors experiences. Persico knows just how complicated that readjustment phase can be. He served in Afghanistan as an explosive ordnance disposal technician for the U.S. Air Force. He spoke with Edward O'Brien yesterday about his experience in the war zone and why he feels the outreach program is good for those who've experienced the stresses of combat.
I served with Task Force Paladin in southern Afghanistan, largely in the Kandahar and Helmand provinces, and I was on an explosive ordnance disposal team, part of a larger counter-IED team, and our mission was to defeat IED networks, which was crucial because that's the greatest cause of casualties, coalition casualties, as well as the Afghan casualties in the war.
Why EOD? Did you get assigned there, or is that something you volunteer for?
There's no such thing as just getting assigned to EOD. It's actually so dangerous that at any point in your career, you can actually say, hey, I don't want to do this anymore, and they have to let you out of it. So, no, it was definitely, I volunteered to do it, and it just seemed like a great challenge. And, you know, when I went through the school, there was probably about a 75% attrition rate, and I wanted to work with the best, so that's what I chose to do.
Jeez, Tristan, I mean, that's pretty intense. But if I had to guess, I guess it was either extremely hot or cold, chaotic, and again, just incredibly stressful. And you lost some friends, didn't you?
Yeah, I sure did. I lost my closest friend, Brian Berkey, in 2009. He was killed by an enemy sniper. That was a really devastating, dark part of my life.
When you were there, did you ever think of home back in Montana, or was your mind just so focused, so absorbed in living one day to the next?
No, you know, being in Afghanistan was surprisingly stress-free, you know. Back here at home, I got to worry about paying bills and doing homework, and I got a pregnant wife at home and two stepdaughters, you know. There's a lot of stuff to worry about. Where there is, all you have to worry about is not getting killed and not letting your friends get killed, you know, which is that it sounds like it's a lot more stressful, but really it's not quite as cumulative, you know. There's only two major things to worry about instead of 1,000 minor things. But, you know, back to your question, in between responses or in between missions, yeah, I constantly thought of Montana, you know. I was in a really dreary, brown, hot place. So naturally, my mind is going to travel to the best place that I know in the world is Montana.
Mm. How long did you serve?
I was in Afghanistan for 5 months. I came home early to escort my friend's body.
What was it like when you got back? Was it more difficult than you would have expected or easier than you would have expected?
I don't know, coming back under those circumstances, I didn't really have expectations, but I found it extremely difficult adjusting to, you know, a non-combat way of life after being over there. And after a while, it really, really took its toll, and I ended up having to seek help for anger issues or post-traumatic stress or anything like that.
Can you talk about that more? Why was it difficult adjusting to non-combat life?
It's hard to put words to why it was difficult. For one thing, I was in the Air Force, and largely it's a very non-combative culture. And here we are, these guys who are heavily involved in combat, and that branch of the military just didn't know how to deal with us at the time. Since then, they've really turned 180 and gotten a lot better at it, but, you know, it was kind of just a difficult transition.
You lead the Veterans Outreach Program, which is sponsored by the Montana Wilderness Association. What is it, and did you create it, actually?
Yes, I mean, I certainly do not take all the credit. What happened is a fellow from the Montana Wilderness Association spoke at one of my classes at the U of M, and his name's Zach Porter, and he's the Next Gen Wilderness Leader Program Director. Our main goal is for veterans to be able to connect with each other in a wilderness setting. So what we do is, at no cost to the veteran, we plan trips into the backcountry and try to get about a half a dozen veterans, you know, 6 to 8 vets together, and do overnight or day trips into the backcountry. We're also promoting stewardship projects, such as work on the Continental Divide Trail, and also, you know, wilderness education about current policies and current events and wilderness affairs.
What sort of impact does this program have on participants, do you think?
It has a multitude of impacts. You know, first and foremost, veterans get to connect with each other, and that's something that's dearly missed once you leave the military community. And, you know, that's just so important, I think, especially in a wilderness setting where the naturally therapeutic values of wilderness. And then on the other hand, it helps wilderness too, because veterans are a very, you know, well-respected group, and they have overwhelming support from the public. So the more appreciation veterans gather, the more outspoken they'll be on wilderness issues.
You mentioned the therapeutic values of wilderness. What does that mean? Just peace and quiet?
Peace and quiet, the natural decompression that occurs when we take a step out of society temporarily, just the beauty and the serenity we find in our natural areas, wilderness areas.
Justin, what is this Champions of Change Award?
The Champion of Change program is a White House program that recognizes people that are trying to make a difference within their community at the grassroots level, and that's just what we're trying to do within the Montana's veteran community.
Have you been through the award ceremony yet?
Yes, I was just walking through from the award ceremony to a meeting with Senator Walsh's staff.
How'd it go? I assume you met the president.
No, actually, he had far more important stuff to do today. He's presenting the Medal of Honor to several recipients of Hispanic and Jewish backgrounds that should have received it but didn't due to racial prejudice generations ago. So I completely understand why he wasn't there.
Yeah.
And then the Secretary of Interior was there, and that was a real honor to meet her. And it was a good experience being around all these other people from around the country and just seeing what everybody else is up to.
Mm-hmm. I know you're studying at UM right now. What are your long-term plans, Tristan?
My long-term plans? Someday I'd like to work for a federal agency as a public servant. Watching over or managing or caring for a wilderness area would be my dream job.
Well, I've been speaking with Tristan Persico. Congratulations. You were honored today for your work with the Montana Wilderness Association's Veteran Outreach Program, which is being honored with the White House Champions of Change Program. Thank you for your time, and I hope this doesn't ring hollow, but thank you very much for your service as well.
Thank you, Ed. Have a great day.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, tonight, rain showers are likely with some scattered snow and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect from midnight tonight to noon tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy. Expect snow and areas of blowing snow over the mountains of the Rocky Mountain Front. Elsewhere, there's a slight chance of snow showers. Lows will be 25 to 30 degrees over the Rocky Mountain Front. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour, increasing to 65 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. Snow is likely with areas of blowing snow over the mountains of the Rocky Mountain Front. Elsewhere, there's a chance of rain and snow in the morning. There should be some areas of blowing snow with a chance of snow tomorrow afternoon. Highs should be 30 to 40 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 60 miles per hour over the Rocky Mountain Front. In southwest Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with a chance of snow over the western mountains. Elsewhere, there's a slight chance of snow showers after midnight. Low should be 15 to 25 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 35 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, look for increasing clouds, bringing a chance of snow and highs in the 30s. Wind gusts could reach up to 40 miles per hour. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli County. Recently, I attended the American Society on Aging's ASA National Conference, the largest one related to aging in the country. For 60 years, ASA has studied the issues and opportunities surrounding our nation as we age. Tonight, I will share some of the exciting conference highlights. One of the most dynamic and thought-provoking sessions focused on the future of aging and featured esteemed presenters from around the country, like Joseph Coughlin, Director of Age Lab at MIT, and Ken Dykewall, CEO of AgeWave, among others. To put their remarks in context, panelists shared these significant demographic facts for the future of aging. By the year 2030, only 16 years from now, more people will be over the age of 65 than under the age of 15. People turning 50 today can expect to live at least another 30 years. Currently, 47% of all people over the age of 85 have Alzheimer's. Panel members addressed several key areas that, as a society and through good public policy, can make a difference in how successfully we age. I could speak at length about any one of these, but tonight I will simply give you an overview. The first pillar for successful aging is the need for us to build communities that are age-friendly and livable for all ages. This encompasses housing, access to health care, roads, walkways, transportation, and more. For example, a city that is walkable by all ages is one that you can walk with a stroller as well as a wheelchair. Consider housing needs. which are often the same for the young as well as older adults. The second area involves health and wellness. Starting with the epidemic of Alzheimer's disease, we need to put our brightest scientists to work finding a cure. Pharmaceutical companies and medical universities should work together to make this a priority, because without a cure, our nation's health care costs will only escalate. In addition, individuals need to take personal responsibility for their own health. With easily accessible health programs and affordable wellness opportunities, millions of Americans can better manage their chronic disease or, better yet, prevent them. A big part of the future of aging relates to social responsibility. Community members need to come together as intergenerational volunteers to help others. There is simply no way we will ever be able to support all the care needs of older adults without the help of volunteers. Today's oldest vital adults, those already engaged and involved in the community, are a huge asset. Baby boomers, not always known for their volunteerism, can step it up. Did you know the average retiree watches 47 hours of TV a week? Imagine what could be accomplished if those retirees who can get out to help would do so. Educational systems that address the third age of life are another essential pillar of successful aging. The third age is described as life after work and children. Long before a person retires, they need to be educated on how to prepare for longevity. This includes financial planning, encore careers, and how to spend some of your retirement years towards service to your community. Technology will obviously hold important economic and service delivery solutions for the future. How might a vulnerable elderly person receive health care without visiting the doctor every time they have a health concern? Technology can be the answer. Once we engage engineers, mathematicians, and technologists to work together to develop economical applications. Technology can also help people safely stay at home or travel to appointments. Already developed is a spoon that can automatically balance a shaking hand, particularly useful for people with Parkinson's disease who can't control trembling. Wheelchairs are being developed that will operate with voice command. Telehealth is opening doors for rural and isolated people to receive face-to-face consultations with a provider who can monitor things like blood pressure and oxygen levels through easy at-home systems. By catching warning signs early, costly readmissions to the hospital are reduced. In our rural state, telehealth will be especially helpful. The final key area for successful aging will be through collaborations and partnerships of not-for-profit and for-profit organizations. For-profits can create innovative approaches to solving problems with technology and capital. Not-for-profits understand the needs of the people they serve. Combining the two can only help strengthen all other pillars to make our communities places to age successfully. As we look to our future, we need to plan as if we will live to be 100 years old. Many of us likely will. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.